I'm Paul Harris. Thanks for listening this morning. Andrew Basevich served our country in the United States Army. He retired with the rank of colonel. He now is a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. His family's contribution to our country continued when his son served in the United States Army, went off to war, and unfortunately died in Iraq. Andrew has written about war in his new book called Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Colonel, thank you for your service and your family's service, and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on here is because earlier this week, President Obama was on TV announcing the official end to combat operations in Iraq. And you were quoted in a newspaper article this week of saying, you know, if we can't have a victory parade, we at least ought to be able to make some definitive conclusions about this war at this point. It just doesn't seem that we're going to do so. We want to just move on, sadly. What did you mean by that?
Well, you remember the president called upon us to turn the page on the Iraq war. That was the phrase he used in the speech. And I think that would be a profound mistake. I think the war was ill-advised and mismanaged from the outset. Other people will disagree with that judgment, and that's fine. But I would think we all ought to agree that this was an enormously important chapter in American life. I don't think anybody could make the argument that it went swimmingly well. We've spent roughly $1 trillion. We've lost 4,400 American lives. There are thousands of other soldiers that have been severely injured. And it seems to me one ought to ask, what did we get out of all this? And perhaps more importantly, what should we learn from all of this? And in that regard, the turn the page and move on argument is one that I think really doesn't stand up too well.
So it's time not to just move forward, but to remember mistakes that have been made and policies that have gotten us where we are.
Yeah, and again, I would acknowledge that given the fact that the war has been so contentious from the very outset, coming to some commonly accepted set of conclusions about what we should learn will involve a certain amount of debate and dialogue. I have my own views about what we ought to take away from the Iraq war, but I certainly would not be so arrogant as to insist that my conclusions have to be everybody else's conclusions. I simply think it is fundamentally wrong and also foolish to move on without trying to identify what those lessons should be.
The phrase permanent war is right there in the subtitle of your book. That's what we're mired in the Middle East now, isn't it?
Well, that's my fear. Again, I think one of the things that the book tries to argue is that we should not put the responsibility for our present predicament on any one administration or any one president. I think that Washington, broadly defined, has bought into a playbook of national security policy that may once have worked, may have been a legitimate playbook back in the 40s and 1950s, but it doesn't work anymore. And we need to wake up and acknowledge that fact. If we don't recognize the existence of the playbook, and if we don't recognize that the plays don't work anymore, then we're just going to continue to blunder down this path, which does seem to me to be, in essence, a path of permanent war.
It is a path that we've been on for a long time. In fact, back to the 50s, President Eisenhower warned us in his farewell address about the military-industrial complex. I'm 52 years old now, and I don't think in my lifetime we've had a war that we could declare was a great victory. Yes, the Gulf War in the early 90s, we did the job of getting Saddam Hussein and his Republican Guard out of Kuwait. But if you count the other conflicts that we've been involved in, including this long one in Afghanistan, the long one in Iraq, the long one in Vietnam, and anything else along the way, except for the weekend we kicked some people out of Grenada who were med students, I don't know that we can put the word victory next to any American efforts in the last half century. And yet we continue to use this as part of our foreign policy, don't we?
Well, I think you're putting your finger on something that's very, very important. The expectations that existed when we invaded Iraq back in 2003 were informed by a belief that our military forces were so superior that a decisive victory was all but guaranteed, that the war would be short and would end conclusively, and that we'd be able to reap significant political benefits as a consequence. All that turned out to be simply wrong. Not wrong because President Bush wished to do ill to the country. Of course he didn't. Wrong, I think, because there exists in Washington, and to some degree there exists in the country at large, a false understanding of war. I mean, one of the things that we should learn from Iraq is that war is a very uncertain instrument, that once you unleash the dogs of war, you really have precious control over how things are going to go. The one thing you probably can count on is that the costs are going to be much greater than you anticipate. And that's not an argument that says never go to war. There are times when you have to fight. It is an argument that says see war as an absolute last resort, only to be undertaken when there really exists no alternatives. Well, there were alternatives in Iraq, and to tell you the truth, I think that there are alternatives in Afghanistan, and I regret deeply that almost 9 years after 9/11, there still is an unwillingness, I think, to acknowledge that there are alternative ways to go about trying to prevent the recurrence of a 9/11. We still buy into this notion that making war on terror is the only way to go.
Do you think that this current policy is dangerous?
Well, it's not dangerous in the sense that Afghanistan's going to blow up into being World War III, but it is dangerous, I think, in two respects. The first danger is that we are just heading down the road toward bankruptcy, and our propensity for war is accelerating our path down that path. I was struck, I think it's within the past week, that Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said that the greatest threat to U.S. national security is our growing debt. And if indeed that's the case, and I think it might be the case, then it seems to me there's going to have to be big changes in the way we manage our affairs and big changes in our willingness just to shovel money at the Pentagon. So that's the danger. The second danger, I think, is we need to acknowledge the fact that U.S. military operations in the Islamic world are not reducing the animosity in that part of the world directed against us. No, it's increasing the animosity. So what we are doing is creating a fertile field in which Al-Qaeda can find new recruits, and that's making the problem worse.
Yeah, the recruiting done by the enemy, based on what you're doing to try to help the people of that country, seems like a paradox, and yet that's exactly what we're experiencing right now.
It's because, even if we are operating with the best will in the world, I think outsiders inevitably end up being clumsy in trying to, quote-unquote, help. I mean, if 100,000 Egyptians, 100,000 Egyptian soldiers came to Missouri with the intention of helping Missourians learn how to manage their own affairs, even if those 100,000 Egyptians had the best will in the world, my bet is that they would create havoc, and within about 6 months, the people of Missouri would be up in arms trying to get these Egyptian soldiers to get the hell out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why should we assume, as Americans, that our intentions are any better, or that our ability to understand what the people of Afghanistan need or want is in any way superior to what Egyptians would imagine the people of Missouri need or want?
Okay, so let's go back then to Eisenhower's military-industrial complex. Much of what we do in terms of foreign policy, driven by the Pentagon, driven by the industrial contractors who are providing the planes, the ammunition, all the rest of that sort of stuff. How can you change policy when they still have so much power?
Well, only with great difficulty. That speech, we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of the Eisenhower farewell address this coming January. I hope that it will be a moment when many Americans will go back to that speech and read it for themselves. We remember it because that's where the phrase military-industrial complex came from. I think we should remember the speech for the charge that Eisenhower makes to us during the course of that speech. And what he says basically is, look, if we're going to be able to ensure that this vast military power can be employed in ways that are consistent with our democratic values, then what's needed, he said, is an alert and knowledgeable citizenry. That's the phrase, alert and knowledgeable citizenry. So if we want to see change, or if we want at least to prevent the military-industrial complex and the national security state from behaving in ways that are irresponsible, then we must be alert and we must be knowledgeable. I think that the American people have failed to fulfill that charge from President Eisenhower.
You served in the United States military. Your son died in Iraq fighting in this war. And yet we have civilian leadership in this country, and that is always the way it's been, the commander-in-chief, a civilian. But for several presidencies now, we've got presidents who did not serve in the military, and the men who were in charge when we went into Afghanistan and Iraq, President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Secretary of Defense Dick Rumsfeld and even Paul Wolfowitz, these are guys who never served in war. How does that make things different from before?
Well, I think it would be wrong for us to say that, you know, in order to be an effective commander-in-chief, you have to be a veteran. Probably the two greatest commanders-in-chief we ever had were Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, and they were not, you know, they had not, I think Lincoln served a couple weeks as a militiaman in the Black Hawk War, and Franklin Roosevelt had never served. So it's not as if military experience is a prerequisite to understand war at the highest levels. I do think that given our propensity to use force and to emphasize military power, it is in general a good thing to have our elites include a reasonable seasoning of veterans. And when I say elites, I don't simply mean the people who are working in the Pentagon or the State Department, but the people who are running the op-ed pages of major newspapers, the people who are making decisions in the TV networks about what stories to cover and how, the people who are running universities and running major corporations. I think that veterans may be somewhat more skeptical of arguments that war is an easy proposition, and therefore having that skepticism in important parts of our society would be a useful thing.
We have Congress that seems kind of weak-willed about changing this policy. The consensus in that town on national security has been that this is the way we go about dealing with the world. Is there any change possible with the people who are there now, and more importantly, with the public who votes for those people?
Well, I am completely pessimistic when it comes to the Congress. I know that there will be honorable exceptions to what I'm about to say, but it really does seem to me that both houses of Congress and both parties are committed to the proposition that nothing should get in the way of reelecting incumbents. In order for incumbent to be reelected, they got to raise tons of money. In order to raise tons of money, they have to satisfy corporate and other large institutional interests, and all that really creates almost an insurmountable barrier to bringing about change, and in particular to taking on something like the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
So if we're looking to Congress to save the day, we're going to have to be mighty patient. I do think that Eisenhower was right that the people need to be the ones who demand change. But there, again, the people cannot simply defer to Washington. We have this notion that somehow the people in Washington are smarter than the rest of us, or that because they have security clearances, that they have key information. My own sense is that's simply not the case. It's funny, the spirit of the country right now, particularly in the Tea Party realm, is one of great suspicion of Washington. But it doesn't seem that the suspicion of Washington entirely connects to Washington's views on national security policy.
Yeah.
There, the tendency is to say, well, you know, whatever the Secretary of Defense or the generals want, that's what we have to do. I would like to see Americans ask lots of tough questions about why we are spending as much money as we're spending, where the money is going, what we get in return for the sacrifices made for our soldiers, and why there are not ways that to keep the country safe that would be cheaper and would require fewer sacrifices by those who serve in uniform.
I agree 100%. And by the way, it's patriotic to ask those questions. That's the backbone of this country. Colonel Andrew Bacevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, author of a terrific new book called Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.